Welcome back to the program. Maybe it's technology or just the very nature of society today, but we seem to have long lost the art of writing letters. Letters were once a way we touch base with our friends, a way of exchanging ideas and feelings, of sharing the complexity and eccentricities of daily life. It should be no surprise, then, that one of our greatest literary lights of the 20th century, William Styron, the author of Lie Down in Darkness, Confessions of Nat Turner, Sophie's Choice, and the seminal work on depression, Darkness Visible, should have written a collection of letters that will truly stand the test of time and stand up to any of the literary greats. Years after his death in 2006, Rose Styron, his bride of 53 years, has organized that collection of over 1,000 letters and postcards. They are together in a new volume entitled Selected Letters of William Styron, and it is my pleasure to welcome Rose Styron here to the program. Rose, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
Delight to have you here. One of the great stories is how you discovered all of these letters. You didn't even know that Bill had written so many over the years.
I had no idea. I thought while he was taking, 5 years to write The Confessions of Nat Turner and 7 years to write Sophie's Choice, I discovered that probably half the time he was upstairs writing letters and I hadn't a clue.
And it was really finding the letters that people had written him that got you started on this.
That's right. I went through to collect his papers first when he died, and then I looked in the bureau drawers next to his desk, and they were stuffed with letters that he had received from friends and colleagues and family and mentors and young writers and fans that he had collected and saved personally. He never made copies of his own letters, so I had no idea what he had written.
And because he didn't make copies of his own letters, there's a sense that he certainly wasn't thinking about this with respect to posterity.
I think he was not. I think Bill, all his life, thought and spoke and wrote in the moment, and that he wrote all kinds of things to individual different friends that he would never have said aloud or never remembered that he had said.
In many ways, it was almost, as you've talked about, a kind of secret life, a second life that he had going on in these correspondence.
I think it was. It allowed him to be funny. It allowed him to be sardonic. It was so special to each individual friend. You know, to Willie Morris, his southern friend, he signed everything Stingo and almost wrote in that voice. To John Marquand, a northern friend, he was Stibo. To Peter Matheson, whom he had known since Paris Review days, he would sign himself Porter. And it was almost like different fictional characters that he wrote in, but it was really what he was thinking.
One of the things that's striking is how many of these letters talk also about phone calls, that this sense of staying in touch was so important to him. He makes reference in so many of the letters to phone calls he's had with these people.
I forgot that. I'm glad you reminded me. He did value friendship more than anything in life, I think. And so phone calls to people that he saw often and wanted to continue conversations with meant that he wrote fewer letters to those people. He wrote volumes to, say, James Jones, who lived in Paris, but very few to Peter, who lived in Long Island, because they talked.
Talk a little bit about friendship, the importance of it.
I think, having been a rather lonely little boy, the only child in a household where the mother was sick all the time, and he was sent off to play with one child or another when things got bad, he clung to that kind of friendship. And I think by the time he had Marine Corps buddies who saw him through, because he was not a fan of being in the Marine Corps, although he was a pretty good guy at it. And then at college, his professor, William Blackburn, became such a dear friend, and there were college buddies who saw him through rather poverty-stricken times in New York. And then when he was in New York, he made friends with the other writers who were there, like Norman Mailer and Jones and so forth. And they gave him a sense of himself and a sense of confidence that he could write and be part of the world, especially when he got to Paris and to Rome and made friends there. He grew in confidence and caring, both about his writing and about his ability to respond to the world.
Over the years, did you and Bill exchange letters?
Very few. I think I found three that he'd written to me, but we were together most of the time, except when I was off on my Amnesty International trips to various countries, and I certainly couldn't write to him then or him to me. And there were a few from times when he went to Paris and stayed or went to Russia with Robert Lowell. But that was really, those are the only letters between us.
How did you see your place in this vast panoply of friendship and all of these relationships that he had?
Well, the longer we were married, the more mutual I felt they were. And when I read the letters, it surprised me how he replicated and recorded our mutual life with these friends. And so I felt it was very much Bill and me and them, and that Bill did not have many friendships that I was not included in.
As you read all of these letters and putting the selected letters together, in many ways it was reliving your own life.
It definitely was. Bill has the most extraordinary memory, and I don't. And when I was flitting around as a mother or hostess or activist, whatever I was doing, I found I remembered very little, except the dramatic moments, which are always emblazoned in your brain. But the run-of-the-mill and just the good times and a lot of the family stuff, I found Bill had recorded beautifully. I had no idea he was doing that. He was sitting still and looking. And so he gave me back a wonderful view of our life together. I mean, the ups and downs of it, of course. That's what you have in a long marriage. But there was nothing in it that I wished I hadn't read.
We should also point out that all of these were written in longhand. Bill didn't use a typewriter or a computer, that this was all handwritten.
It was, all of it. And he had beautiful handwriting. And when he used to read to me every night what he'd written in the afternoon, I would type it the next morning, but his handwriting was so beautiful, I had no trouble. On the other hand, I never would have been able to do this book if a young man named Blake Gilpin, who was getting his PhD at Yale, hadn't come to me and agreed to transcribe every letter and put them in chronological order, which is what his longtime editor Bob Loomis at Random House wanted done.
Talk a little bit about the letters that Bill wrote during his depression and what you gathered or what you learned, if anything, new from those.
Oh, that's really a difficult subject for me, but I was very moved to see which of his friends he talked about his depression to. There were only a few at that point, which included, I'd say, the last ones were to Peter Matheson. He didn't understand, I think, in the beginning of the depression, how it changed his writing and how there were, for the first time, things he wrote that couldn't be published, and it, you know, made him cross. But he understood and cared about it, and writing Darkness Visible, which paralleled some of the letters, really helped heal him.
Of all of the letters, which one surprised you the most?
I think, because and I've been thinking about this because it's inauguration time.
Right.
I was surprised at the detail and delight in which he recorded our visits to the White House, our lucky knowing of Presidents Kennedy and Clinton and Carter and Reagan. It's just that time of the year that's made me kind of happiest about re-recording those, and it made me really wish that he had known Obama, because he would have been very excited about his presidency.
How many more letters were there that you weren't able to include?
God. Well, as I said to somebody, when I asked for these letters, I had no idea that I was going to get more than a couple hundred, and it suddenly looked like the Sorcerer's Apprentice in my mailbox in Roxbury, Connecticut, many days, as they, thousand. I mean, I'd say there were, I got at least 1,500 letters, and Random House didn't want more than a 500-page book, so we had to edit them down. And I really didn't count. I have loads that weren't used, but a lot of them were because he had done, you know, 15 to the same person, and mm-hmm. we tried to cut that down.
There were postcards as well, even short little notes.
There were, and that was great fun. I remember opening the top drawer, and a postcard from John Updike fell out, and there was one from Mia Farrow, and... they were just, you know, some people wrote postcards, and that was lots of fun.
It's so interesting to look at it in the context of today, as I mentioned in the introduction, where the art of letter writing has faded away so much.
I know. It is, and I'm not a letter writer, so I'm quite astounded and really appreciative of the writing of letters, because you get a sense of the writer's biography as he saw it. It was almost like this was Bill's for me, because there were so many letters from childhood and teenage that were not included in the book. We started when he became a writer in college, but there were lots of letters before that, and reading the whole thing was like reading, you know, a novel where Bill was the first person and we were his characters. And I'm sure I've read a lot of other letters recently, and I think that's what you get, is the real inner person.
It's a kind of unofficial biography in a way.
Yes.
Rose Styron. The book is The Selected Letters of William Styron. Rose, I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff.